Bloomberg on the Economy with Mike McKee and Carol Masser.
All right, we've talked the markets, we've talked about Europe. Time to talk specifically about the U.S. economy. Here to help us with that, Ellen Zentner. She's senior U.S. economist over at Nomura Securities International. Ellen, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
So we got the jobs report on Friday. You guys put out some research saying that the unemployment is likely to get the Fed to act at this point. Why so?
Yeah, I think that for us, the report was really a wash for the Fed in that we think that they were on an easing bias before this employment report, and they remain on an easing bias. So you have that headline number that showed we created more than 160,000 jobs in July, and that was great news for what it says about current economic activity. But then you turn to the unemployment rate, which is calculated off a different survey, the household survey in that report, and it showed that the unemployment rate ticked up to 8.3%. So it's really going in the wrong direction for the Fed's liking. And when the Fed tied further accommodation to sustained, if we fail to get sustained improvement in the labor market, you know, the unemployment rate certainly doesn't seem like sustained improvement in the labor market, does it?
Well, no. But to what extent is it their job to, make it happen?
Well, you know, the Chairman Bernanke has been very vocal about believing that, yes, there's some structural unemployment in the labor market, but that the majority of the unemployment rate is still the result of a deep cyclical downturn that we're just growing very slowly out of it. And if that's the case, the Fed believes that monetary policy can have an effect on labor markets. And they remain extremely determined to affect a greater recovery in the labor market as long as they feel it's in their wherewithal. And they admittedly, you know, more quantitative easing or other kinds of easing measures, you know, have a limited impact on the economy. But plenty of participants on the FOMC have said as long as it has even a modicum of or makes a modicum of difference, they're willing to do it. And so, you know, they clearly remain on the easing bias. And we don't think that the Friday jobs report, you know, showing that we created a fairly healthy round, at least compared to the prior months of jobs, does anything to change that easing bias.
What's
on the
Fed. Trigger then? Well, I mean, how bad would September, the August number in September have to be to make them act on their bias?
Well, I think we just continue to watch the unemployment rate. I mean, meeting that we just had was a two-day meeting for the FOMC. It was one of those one-day meetings that was changed to a two-day meeting when they went to this two-day schedule. But it didn't come with a press conference or updated forecast tables from the Fed that would allow the committee to more clearly communicate their intentions around further easing. So they strengthened up the language in the statement. They made it was a meager adjustment, but it was there. They made it a little bit more strong language that they were willing to move. And I think that's in anticipation of this September meeting that, again, is a two-day meeting, but it'll come with the chairman's press conference and new forecast tables from Fed participants where they're able to better communicate whatever change it is they decide to make in September. We also get, don't forget, we've got Bernanke's August 31st Jackson Hole speech where he'll have plenty of opportunity to signal something to the markets if he feels like further easing, policy easing is imminent. You know, certainly he used that venue last year in order to signal further easing was coming, and I think markets will be watching his speech closely to see if he does that again.
Ellen, Mike's going to be there, but do you expect to get something out of that Jackson Hole meeting, or it's kind of up in the air at this point?
It is up in the air, but I think that the overwhelming anticipation is that we will get some indication from the chairman on at least how he feels about the outlook. You know, he has a way, any Fed chairman we had has had a way of inserting telltale signs, you know, even with just the flip of a word or the characterization of data. You know, we even mark down that there's a big difference between using modest and moderate these days in terms of how the economy is doing. And so he'll be able to provide a subtle of a hint or as strong of a hint as he wants. But I can't imagine that he would lessen the intention or the perceived intention of the Fed toward more easing. I mean, in the statement, it was pretty clear. We will act further if we don't see a sustained improvement in the labor market. And the unemployment rate stalling out for the last few months at 8.2%, then moving up to 8.3% in July, and all that with another drop in the labor force participation rate, that's not sustained improvement in the labor market. That's deteriorating labor market conditions. So I can't imagine that he would have less of a tone of intentions of further easing at the Jackson Hole summit.
All right, draw us a picture of how what the Fed does gets to the labor market. What can they do that will bring down unemployment?
Well, right now their hope is just to maintain those extraordinarily low costs of credit, of funding credit. Unfortunately, the amount of accommodation they've put in place would normally have a huge effect on markets, but you've got corporations that have a ton of cash and don't necessarily need to access the credit markets fully in order to fund operations. But the biggest piece of that is you've got households not really willing to take on more debt. We're still very much mired in this mindset of paying down our debt loads. And
you say it like it's a bad. You say it. You almost say it like it's a bad thing.
You know what, Carol? We always say the same thing. It's a bad thing in the short run. In the long run, of course, we want households to make reparations and be more prepared for emergency
situations.
But not
just right now when we need the money pumping into the economy.
Yeah, not right now. And I know that. I don't know about you, but I've been out, doing my fair share of spending, but I can't support it all on my own. Yeah. I need some help. So
that's what I tell my husband.
I'll tell your husband. I'll tell Mike he needs to get out and spend, especially when he's in Jackson Hole. He can buy a new winter coat and get some spurs and boots while he's out there.
There you go.
A horse, maybe.
Buy a horse, too, right? So anyway, I'm fresh out of transitions here. All right, let's go back to the Fed.
Well, Mike, when we were going to break, you had mentioned Reinhardt and Rogoff right before break.
Yeah.
They're that 2009 book, This Time is Different, is something that we've really embraced here in terms of developing this thesis of why the U.S. would be in a slow-growth, low-rate environment for possibly decades, pointing out that we've been here before. If you look at the 1929 crash, interest rates remained low for a few decades after that. And it all goes back to Reinhardt and Rogoff's work on how do developed nations grow out of financial crisis. There are just similarities throughout time, all wrapped up in this deleveraging process and how many years that take. The public sector has been ongoing. Corporations deleveraged pretty quickly. U.S. households, it's ongoing with the balance sheet reparations. And then after the first few years or first several years of private sector deleveraging, the public sector kicks in. And that's exactly what we're facing here toward the end of the year with fiscal consolidation, what comes out of bridging the fiscal cliff, how much tax reform and spending cuts will Congress be able to manage, and we'll really have some fiscal consolidation out of that, and that will also depress growth for a time.
Which, suggests that a lot of this is out of the Fed's control.
A lot of it is out of the Fed's control, though they would never admit that. But more to the point, it means that the Fed is going to have to leave rates very low and remain extremely accommodative for quite some time, because they're going to be faced with slow economic growth for quite some time. So whether you argue, we need even more accommodation than what we've got now, you certainly couldn't argue that the Fed should remove accommodation, or that now is the time to start normalizing interest rates. Even when the Fed does decide that it looks like they should start lifting interest rates off the bottom, we have to temper our expectations on just how far they can go. We found that throughout history, they can only raise rates about 200 basis points before choking off economic activity. This time, we're just jumping off a very low point. So you're talking about a 200 basis point rise off of zero, roughly, is about how much the Fed's going to be able to do when they do start normalizing rates.
Ellen, do we need to be worried, and I bring this up because we had John Taylor on, to be worried about the implications of this very easy monetary policy that we're seeing globally? Do we need to be worried about the implications yet, or you're saying don't even go there yet?
Well, I think we always have to keep an eye open to, what bubbles could be, sort of foaming up out there because, you know, a lot of the bubbles are unforeseen. I mean, I think even the chairman himself has pointed out that bubbles are extremely difficult to detect. And who knows, in this extraordinary environment, unprecedented Fed policy environment that we're in and that we're going to be in for some time, who knows what bubbles out there are building that'll be a future concern. But it's something we have to constantly be looking toward.
Now, you say we don't want to see the Fed raising interest rates, which is somewhat understandable. But do you think that there would be a measurable difference from them taking additional action at this point? Or I wonder sometimes if they risk a little credibility by, you know, saying we're doing X, Y, and Z and nobody notices and people start to dismiss the Fed.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, from their own studies, they've shown that, let's say, the first time that they announced quantitative easing, it had a fairly big impact on markets because it was a complete surprise and something new. And then with each subsequent announcement, we haven't gotten as near an impact. This time around, if they're going to announce something like further quantitative easing, it's going to have to be a pretty sizable program to get, as you said, a measurable impact on rates. You know, something that I think that's why, you know, the consensus around expectations is that they would have to announce about $600 billion for it to really have an impact. And they can't just continually, for the foreseeable future, go bigger and better with these QE programs. Even quantitative easing has its limits because there's only so many treasuries the Fed can buy. Even with the MBS space, which is where economists largely believe a further quantitative easing program would be concentrated, the Fed can buy at a pace of maybe roughly $80 billion a month, and that's it. I mean, there are limitations to how much the Fed can buy. But again, going back to participants' comments on the committee, you know, they've specifically said if there's even one iota of difference that one of these programs can make, they'll do it. And so I wouldn't say that, you know, just because the impact is lessening that they're going to be less apt to do these programs.
And that plays into some comments that the Fed chairman's making today. He's got some remarks. We've just seen the prepared marks. There's a conference in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and apparently he is, I don't think he's said it yet, but he's expected to say that gauges of the U.S. economy's strength may fail to measure the sufferings of individual citizens. So he's worried about, even though that there are maybe some more upbeat data points that we've seen, that it's still, there are many, many individuals out there that are struggling. And that's his point, right? We've fixed essentially the financial system. We've made certainly a lot of movements in the right direction, Ellen, at this point. Housing is one of them. We've seen certainly some improvements. But yet, there are many individuals out there that are still in a very, very tough way.
Yeah, and I think what's influencing his comments there is that he's been very adamant about making reparations, again, going back to the labor market. Everything is about the labor market. And in Friday's payroll report, you know, showing that according to businesses, we created more than 160,000 jobs. But if you looked at the household survey, households reported that 195,000 jobs were lost. So a big divergence there, which can happen because these are two different, measured in two different ways. But, you know, that certainly would jive, the household numbers showing a job loss for July jives more with those consumer confidence numbers that mm-hmm. we're seeing that show consumers are still downbeat on the labor market. And, you know, and certainly in the spending patterns that we've seen, you know, especially at the lower income levels where wage and salary growth matters most to them, we're seeing it influence spending and household sentiment. And so it's just any improvement in the data just doesn't seem to be making it down to the bottom line of the household.
In that number, let me just point out, because I'm looking at your research, of that net loss of 195,000 jobs in July based on the household survey, you point out that nearly the entire decline in jobs was experienced by those workers with a bachelor's degree or higher.
Yeah, those are sort of those little anomalies we like to look for in the data with each of these reports. Just making the point that somebody could say, well, does college pay really? Because all the decline was in college educated workers, except that you look at the unemployment rate for college-educated, and it's 4.1%. And so clearly, and that's versus higher than 12% for those without a high school diploma. So clearly a college degree matters. But it was just sort of one of those odd things in the data you see where it was all in college-educated workers that report they lost a job in July. I do want to make one note. I mean, Friday, when that data report came out, I've never seen so much confusion over it and gotten so many questions surrounding this report because of that huge divergence between payroll survey and the household survey. But there are some adjustments we can make to the household survey to try and get close to the measurement that's used for the payroll survey. So the household survey includes farm workers. It includes multiple job holders. It's just a different survey. But if you make those adjustments to try and measure it the way we do the payroll survey, it would have suggested about 110,000 jobs gained for the household survey. So certainly less than what was reported by establishments, but job gain even for the household sector nonetheless if we make those adjustments to kind of compare apples to apples.
All right, let's kind of wrap it up with where you think we're going to end up. Say the end of the year, what kind of growth are we going to be seeing and what kind of unemployment rate if things play out as you have suggested?
Well, I think we've passed up an FOMC meeting, we passed up a payroll report, we've gotten an ECB meeting out of the way. You know, what else is going to hit the economy? And really, it's that fiscal cliff toward the end of the year. I think that we're going to get a little bit of reprieve here. We'll probably sit around damp and limp, just like the hot summer has got us feeling right now, at least in New York, without much to drive markets while we wait out Bernanke's speech and another FOMC meeting. Otherwise, after Labor Day really is when families and households return from holiday vacation. They're ready to focus on the elections. They're going to be hit by the media reporting, the fiscal cliff and what it means for you and your tax burden. And I think that mm-hmm. it could be a rough time at the end of the year. Even if Congress bridges the fiscal gap, it's not going to come without a contentious debate. We saw what happened last August. I'm afraid that households are going to pull back on holiday spending, knowing that the tax burden is going to be higher come January 1.
In other words, don't start smiling yet.
No, she's we end on, we were cheerful going into this show.
I'm going to go get the mohawk. I think that's the solution.
Ellen Zentner from Nomura, thank you very much for joining us.
Listen to Bloomberg on the Economy weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg 1130 in New York or on Sirius and XM Satellite Radio Channel 113. Copyright 2012.